On December 7, 2007, two-time presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich came to Central Virginia for a fundraiser that brought in over $10,000 for his campaign. The congressman from Cleveland is the third Democratic candidate for the presidency to appear in Charlottesville this fall. Impeachment activist David Swanson formerly worked as press secretary to Representative Kucinich and called upon his old boss to follow in the footsteps of Senator Hillary Clinton and Senator Barack Obama. The event was held on December 7th at the Albemarle County Office Building. Here's David Swanson.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. It's a beautiful crowd. The balcony is filling up there. Congressman Dennis Kucinich is in the building and will be here momentarily. My name is David Swanson. We're going to have a few very brief remarks to welcome the congressman to Charlottesville. And first, I would like to welcome up on this stage Sherry Kraft, the co-chair of the City of Charlottesville Democratic Party. Sherry.
Wow. Wow, this is great. I am here to welcome Dennis Kucinich, and hopefully while he's eating his dinner, the thoughts will go into that room. But on behalf of the Charlottesville Democratic Party, to welcome him, to express our real appreciation for his willingness to come and speak to us, and particularly for his willingness to, during this campaign, to give voice to the anger that many of us have felt over the what this incompetent and morally bankrupt Bush administration has done to our country. I'm not running for anything. But, and particularly for his willingness to hold them accountable and to really put himself on the line to do that. And also for his willingness to just put his democratic values right up front without apology, without equivocation. And it really feels good to hear somebody speak about the values and the priorities that he has. So I think he's a very important person right now on the national scene and a very important part of this presidential campaign. And I hope that we'll help him see that Charlottesville is his kind of town. So thank you.
Next to speak was John Wertman, Vice Chair of the Albemarle County Democratic Party.
Everybody, on behalf of the county party, I want to welcome all of you to our office building. It's great to see so many folks here. We're proud that the congressman is going to join us here tonight. As Sherry said, he really is an unequivocal voice for so many good things that need to happen in 2008. I'm proud of what I've seen in all eight of the candidates, and Congressman Kucinich especially has been speaking out for so many of the values that we all really hold so dear. I was born in 1977, and I've been a Virginia Democrat almost my whole life. And it's, appalling to me that it was 13 years even before I was born that we last had elected a Democrat for president. So I'm ready to change that in 2008. Who's with me? So welcome, Congressman. Welcome, everybody, to Albemarle County. We're so glad you're here tonight, and let's do it next year. Thanks.
And we would also like to take the great pleasure of bringing up to the stage the mayor of the fine city of Charlottesville, Mayor David Brown.
Thank you. On behalf of the city of Charlottesville, and I'm joined by City Councilor Dave Norris, I noticed here this evening, I'd like to welcome Dennis Kucinich to Charlottesville. Yeah! You probably won't be surprised to learn that the cars that we own have bumper stickers on the back of them. But you may, the one that gets the most comment is my 1999 Ford Ranger, currently residing at Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana with one of my sons, has a Kucinich sticker from the last election. And, you know, and I have to say, of all the stickers I've ever had on my car, more people will say something to me when I get out of my truck because of that Kucinich sticker. So, and I think that reflects the fact that of what Charlottesville believes, not Charlottesville Democrats, but what Charlottesville believes, Dennis Kucinich is close to a perfect fit. Wouldn't you agree? You know, we're this island of blue in the sea of red that's Virginia, that used to be Virginia. We're making a change. And so I'm honored to be able to be here tonight to help welcome Dennis Kucinich to Charlottesville. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We do have an event tonight, but we also have a campaign happening in this state that involves things in addition to just showing up and listening to the candidate. So to say a few words about what's happening and what needs to happen in Virginia to elect Congressman Kucinich president, I'd like to bring up the Kucinich for President 2008 Virginia State Coordinator, Andrea Miller.
Good evening, Virginia. I have to speak very carefully. I speak professionally, and I have a very loud voice, so I'll be careful. I am tasked with getting Dennis Kucinich on the ballot here in the great state of Virginia. Yeah. All right. Now, some of you may not know that Virginia is the toughest state of the 50 states in the Union to get on the ballot. We have to have 10,000 signatures of registered voters to put him on the ballot. And I have to turn those signatures in on Friday, December 14th. Now, we are still 3,500 signatures short. So we are going to be looking for everybody who is willing to take a petition home and get your spouse, your significant other, the neighbor that you haven't spoken to in 25 years, to sign that petition and then get them back to me. We brought 200 blank petitions with us. I have Virginia volunteers, please stand up. We've got a lot of volunteers in this room. There they are. Stand up, admit who you are. There they are, my Virginia volunteers. We have been a very small group. There have been 26 of us raising signatures since October 1st. We need a little help to take it over that final hump. And then once we get that done, the next step will be to get Dennis to win the state of Virginia. So we're going to be looking for people to put up yard signs, to go door to door and to tell your neighbors. We've got a really, really, really powerful and fun plan for the state of Virginia. Got to take a moment to do a little quick dedication to some very dedicated volunteers in Virginia. Probably two of Dennis's greatest fans stayed in Richmond tonight to collect signatures at the First Friday event because we were invited to table there. And when I made the call and I said, you know, the Kucinich event in Charlottesville is on December 7th, the person I called, shout out to Rain Burroughs, said, I'll stay in Richmond and I'll get another volunteer to work with me. So we're going to have to get a little picture for Rain or something like that. So anyway, Virginia, let's get Dennis on the ballot. Let's get Dennis to win the state of Virginia. All right, yeah, we can do it. We can do it. We can do it. So thank you all, and I know you're going to have a really incredible evening. I am so excited. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. And last but not least, I want to bring up on the stage one of the wisest and most courageous voices that's been opposing the occupation of Iraq and the trajectory of the Bush-Cheney regime over the past number of years. He is a veteran Army officer and a former senior analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency. Please welcome Mr. Ray McGovern.
Thank you. It was July 14th, 2003, that I first met Dennis Kucinich. This was 2 months after mission accomplished, and many months before and after the search for weapons of mass destruction. He had arranged a press conference for a visiting Australian senior intelligence officer who had had the courage to quit 9 days before the invasion of Iraq. And Andrew Wilkie and I gave a briefing to, there were 13, I counted them, big TV, Klieg lights and cameras and all, and we're all thinking, wow, this is really good reception. Well, we talked for an hour, 11 o'clock in the morning, just right for the press. Curiously enough, not a word on TV that evening, which was a little tip-off as to what to expect. Now, down here, I know, in Albemarle County, you're not allowed to lie, cheat, or steal. So George Bush and Dick Cheney would never make it down this way, but that's small potatoes compared with what Nuremberg termed the supreme international crime, which, my friends, is a war of aggression. To initiate a war of aggression, in the words of Nuremberg, is to perpetrate the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes only in as much as it contains the accumulated evil of the whole. Accumulated evil of the whole. Think about it, folks. Torture, kidnapping, throwing people down black holes and not telling their wives, their children, much less the Red Cross, where they are. I mean, destroying evidence and obstructing justice, that seems like small potatoes compared to what's being covered up here. And Dennis knows about that, and Dennis spoke out about it. As a matter of fact, he had the foresight to talk about Iran well before anyone else was. He invited some of us in early 05 to come and talk about Iran. And you know what his question was? Is war with Iran likely? Number one. Is war with Iran moral? Moral. Could it be defended morally? Now, what other politician are you going to run across that would ask that question? We thought it was likely, and until this Monday, we thought it was more likely than not. If we speak out and we do not allow the further prostitution of intelligence and other information, we can prevent the war against Iran. Now, just to finish up, I have to tell you that my admiration of Congressman Kucinich rests mostly lately. It's hard to pick the best trait, but his courage in initiating articles of impeachment against the Vice President of the United States. Now, back at the end of July, Cindy Sheehan, Reverend Yearwood, and I had a private meeting with Representative John Conyers of Michigan, for whom I had had until then decades worth of admiration. I asked him, I said, Congressman Conyers, I worked in the intelligence apparatus of this country for 30 years, and I have never seen intelligence manufactured, forged, cooked to justify deceiving you in Congress out of your constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. Don't you think that's a high crime? He looked at me and he said, well, sure, but there are so many high crimes going on here in this town that if I had my staff start to impeach everyone, we wouldn't be able to do anything else. That's what he said. And you know what, folks? That's listening to the smart guys, the political advisors from K Street. What they're telling our Democratic colleagues is, look, the president's approval ratings could not be lower. The vice president's still in the toilet. Just don't do anything. Don't do anything. Don't do anything that could give the Republicans, or worse still, Fox News, any reason to persuade the American public that the Democrats are a divisive force. Look, they're trying to impeach our president, you know. And Conyers said to me, we need 218 votes, okay, which is true. If they started the investigation, they get them right away. But we need 218 votes, okay? And if we fail to get them, Fox News would have a field day. So the head of the House Judiciary Committee is letting his behavior under the Constitution be framed and shaped by his fear of Fox News. That's a hell of a situation, folks. And that's the kind of situation that Dennis Kucinich will not abide. And once we start, see, we intelligence professionals feel rather strongly about some things, and one is the Constitution of the United States, you know. And when it talks about impeachment, those of you with some gray in your hair know the difference between the subjunctive mood and the indicative mood. You know, it says the president and vice president shall be impeached upon, shall be removed from office upon impeachment and conviction for crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors. So it's not like, well, it could be if Nancy Pelosi says it's okay. This is the Constitution, folks. We Virginians feel pretty strongly about this, okay? And so what I'm saying here is that we have one person who has distinguished himself for devotion to this Constitution, to a moral outlook on things, and that person is Dennis Kucinich. I recommend him to you. I couldn't favor him more highly than I do. Dennis, where are you?
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you very much.
So a couple very brief comments before we bring up the man that all of you are waiting to hear tonight. I've known Dennis for years, and he is more impressive the more you get to know him. But what I think stands out about his candidacy is that he does not see himself as a spectator. He doesn't vote over and over again to fund the occupation of Iraq and then call himself a critic of the war and complain about it. He voted against it and has voted against every dime to fund it. Dennis does not support corporate trade policies that strip us of our jobs and then complain about how much damage they're doing as if he's watching from his couch. He has committed to ending NAFTA on his first day in office. And Dennis Kucinich does not ask Bush and Cheney to pretty please don't attack Iran while keeping open the option of doing it himself. On the contrary, he proposes to use the power that the Constitution gave the Congress that Ray McGovern has talked about and prevent another aggressive war through the process of impeachment. I could go through every issue, but we'll let Dennis do that. But if we want a congressman, if we want a president who acts rather than watches, then we as citizens, we must act rather than being spectators. If you like a candidate's view, then your democratic instinct should be to assume that your intelligent fellow countrymen and women will like that same candidate. To a citizen of democracy, the question of who is the most viable candidate simply is the question of who do you personally prefer. If you like what you hear tonight, please do not hesitate. Do not settle for less. Do not stop and ask what a TV pundit might instruct you to do. Do not behave as if you cannot win. Instead, when you exit, reach deep into your pockets and contribute further to this campaign. It gives me incredible pleasure to present to Charlottesville, Virginia, the next President of the United States, Congressman Dennis Kucinich.
Hello, Charlottesville. What a turnout. Holy smokes. Thank you so much, and thanks to all of you who have journeyed here this evening, and to the Honorable Mayor and his wife, and to the County Chair who's here, the head of the city delegation, and to all the public officials, all members of the community. I'm so grateful for your presence this evening. As I was waiting in the room next door, there's a candle that has a single filament that lights it. And it caused me to think about what it must have been like hundreds of years ago here when candles flickered in the window, particularly at holiday time, because there's kind of a magic when we see those lights at holiday time. This is a season when people celebrate light. And it's the image of light which attracts me to the potential of our nation in the there's a line in the Psalms that speaks to light, about the light shining in the darkness. There's a, and when I was a child growing up in Catholic school, there's another image of light that I read about it in our Mass. It, in Latin, it said, emitte lucem tuum, send forth your light, et veritatem tuum, and your truth. Light and truth were connected. I think about the light of knowledge that must have helped to animate the thinking of Thomas Jefferson, who in some ways called this party together tonight. And I think about the luminosity of thought, which was imbued into his writings. How he really understood that he was drafting a statement and documents that would give this country the ability to adapt to an undreamed of future. And he had this incredible quality, not just of vision, but of understanding human nature. It's really interesting when you reread the Declaration of Independence to be able to assess some similarities of the times then and the times today, kind of confirming the dictum in French that the more things change, the more they remain the same. Now, this may seem like a Stephen Colbert moment, but let me read to you some relevant lines that are instructive in this particular moment, and that will set the tone for our little chat this evening. From just various paragraphs from the Declaration of Independence, and see if it sounds familiar. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners. He has affected to render the military independent and superior to the civil power, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny. We've been here before. And it's important to remember that throughout human history, there's been moments where people were challenged to be able to stand up and fight for what they believe in, where we've been challenged to determine if we have the wisdom and the knowledge to be self-governing, to be challenged to determine if we can take our courage and meet the moment and all of its difficulties and be able to come together as a community and to state once again, we the people pledging to each other lives, fortune, sacred honor. This is not simply dead history. We're talking about a living testament to the ever-evolving nature of these United States. This is who we are. We must never forget who we are. We must never forget our connection with the aspirations for an unfolding tradition of democratic principle. Oh, we've often missed the mark throughout our history, to be sure. One need only to look at today's plight of Native Americans and to the difficulties which many of our brothers and sisters of color still find themselves as a result of historic injustices. We have to include that in any assessment of where America is and the progress that we've made so that we don't delude ourselves. But also, we recognize that there has been an unfolding of a constitutional tradition which has attempted to be able to right those wrongs and has attempted to be able to form that more perfect union, that it is the American evolution which is instructive here. But there are moments that we need to remember those roots. We need to remember where we came from so we can understand where we're headed. Because if we forget history, it's not simply that we may be condemned to repeat it, but if we forget history, we may lose sight of where we're headed. We're at a moment right now where we're losing our country to lies, to war based on lies, to destruction of civil liberty, to massive debt. When I was going to St. John Cantor's High School many years ago, and I had the rare common sense to take a course in typing, they called it then, a useful skill to be sure, there was a phrase that you had to learn to type which covered all the different keys, and it went, and I could do it in my, you know, with my eyes closed, because that's what you're supposed to be able to do. Now is the time for all good men and women, you know, it wasn't politically correct just then, to come to the aid of their country, okay? Now is the time for all good men and women to come to the aid of our country. So when we see this, to coin another line, usurpation of basic rights, when we see the destruction of the capacity for moral reasoning, the disconnection, not only from the heart, but from the light of knowledge, then we know this is the moment that we're called upon to really reclaim our country. You know, it had been mentioned in the introduction about the Articles of Impeachment. I just want to share something with you. You know, last month, about a month ago at this time, when I went to the floor of the House of Representatives and I was reading those articles, I brought this book with me, which has the Declaration and the Constitution in the same booklet, and I had it right up there on the lectern. And I had my hand on it as I was reading those. As I was reading the documents, I had my hand on this. And I was asking for help. I was asking for help. I was asking for all those people who, whoever stood up and declared what a nation should be about. I wanted their help. I wanted the help of anybody who ever stood for justice. I wanted the help of the founders. I asked for help. We don't do these things alone. They call it the House of Representatives because we represent people. And so I asked for help. We're at a moment in our country's history where we really need to help our country. Our country needs us to stand, to defend this constitutional tradition. When I ran for Congress and was elected on finally the fifth try in 1996, I did not go to Congress to carry forth articles of impeachment against a vice president or a president for that matter. I went to Congress to stand up for the economic rights of people so that we could have a full employment economy and put people back to work so that government can be the employer of last resort when the private sector doesn't provide the jobs, so that we could have a not-for-profit healthcare system, so that we could have education for our children from age 3 all the way through to and including college, fully paid for public colleges and universities, fully paid public education. I went to Congress to stand up for the environment. I went to Congress to certainly take a stand for peace. And I want to recognize the tremendous work for peace and justice which so many people in this community are involved in. I mean, thank you. Thank you for who you are. Thank you for the stands that you take every day. And the work that I came to Congress to do was to be consistent with that. And so I stood up early on, demanding the closing of the School of the Americas, demanding, oh yeah. Demanding that our government confidently engage the world community in a manner which protected human rights. Demanding our trade agreements have human rights, workers' rights, environmental quality principles. I mean, these are the things that I went to Congress for. I did not go to Congress to have to be the person who would be called upon to challenge the vice president and the president with respect to their conduct of office. But I will tell you this. Anyone who truly loves this country, who's in the House of Representatives, and sees the destruction of our Constitution, has a moral obligation to say so and to stand up and fight for that Constitution and demand accountability of those who are violating the Constitution. And that's exactly what I've done, and that's exactly what I will continue to do. Thank you. Thank you. So, it really is a question about what our standards are. You know, I have friends in the Democratic leadership who have said impeachment is off the table. which to me means the Constitution is off the table and in the shredder. Because the founders put Article 2, Section 4 in the Constitution specifically to prevent a monarchy. I was in New Hampshire last week and had the honor of being on a program with John Nichols of The Nation magazine, and John gave one of the most brilliant speeches that I've ever seen about this, a tremendous historical understanding of why it was impeachment was mentioned several times in the Constitution, and it was because our founders fled a monarchy. They didn't want to recreate it here, and so they created a checks and balance system which preserves a democracy. And when the Congress of the United States and our leaders refuses to hold the executive branch accountable, they're destroying the very underpinnings of our democracy, and that's why I'm challenging my own leadership. It's time that the Democrats stood for the Constitution. Impeachment's off the table. You know what I wonder? I wonder what level of offense it would take. Think about this. Think about the precedent we're setting. We're saying that you can lie about a cause for war. You can send troops to their deaths and to be permanently injured. You can kill a million innocent people. You can destroy a country. You can wreck our own economy. Drive us deeply into debt, but impeachment's off the table. You can lie about another cause for war against still another nation. You could threaten that nation with dropping 30,000-pound bunker buster bombs on nuclear research labs, but impeachment's off the table. You can be involved in eavesdropping and wiretapping and rendition and torture, destruction of habeas corpus, but impeachment's off the table. The people of this country have a right to demand, that their Congress stand up for the Constitution, and if it can't stand up for the Constitution, then these members of Congress ought to resign and let people come in who will stand up for the Constitution. So they say impeachment's off the table. Constitution's on the table, okay? Now, we're at a moment right now where the president continues to insist there's a reason to be edgy still about Iran. And there's a Yiddish proverb that says, to a worm in horseradish, the whole world looks like horseradish. This president seems to be so afflicted that everywhere he looks, he sees a cause for war. He obviously needs help from Congress, not for another war, but for a moment of accountability. Now, I see a whole different role for America in the world, and that role is away from the neoconservative strategy of unilateralism, preemption, first strike, and towards what I call strength for peace. Yeah. Now, you know, when I say that, people go, well, oh, peace. Yeah. It is the season, isn't it? Good time to talk about peace. We need to reimagine our capacity for peace. Because there are those who believe that humanity, this is sociology now, is innately violent. We've all heard this. But I reject that. I think violence is a learned capacity, and so is nonviolence, a learned capacity. So the question is, since we have a choice, truly, we do have a choice, then perhaps we should start looking at the choices that we've made and ask if we can choose again and make wiser choices. Those who choose to attack other nations, who see that as the only way that they can engage in politics. We have to question their worldview. Those who believe that war with Iraq was inevitable, we have to question their worldview. Those who believe that it was okay to attack Iraq, later apologized for that and then turned around and said, it's okay to attack Iran. We have to question their worldview. Those who think that war is inevitable, we have to question their worldview, because if you believe war is inevitable, war becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's time that we started to question the thinking of those who would take us into war, which is why I want to go back to that project for the New American Century in 1993, which set the groundwork for this administration's foreign policy and to challenge its underpinnings. Because unilateralism, preemption, first strike have been dead ends. They've made this nation less secure. Strength through peace offers a totally different vision, and that is direct engagement, leaders meeting directly with each other, open dialogue, transparency, the science of human relations, real diplomacy. This is the way we set the framework for an enduring peace and for cooperation between nations. We must believe it's possible. And if we don't have leaders who believe it's possible, then we're headed for more war. And I'm running for President of the United States to prove that it's possible for us to be able to live as one in a world community, in a world that's interconnected and interdependent, where we see each other as brothers and sisters. And well, you might have fights in a family, you still are family, you keep it together, you don't go for war and death and destruction. It's time that we had leadership that saw the capacity to lift up the world instead of tearing it apart, and I'm ready to fill that bill. It's time to create a shift of thinking. We've already seen the path, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. We've already been given a direction that we can move from an economy that's dedicated to war to one that is dedicated to technology for peace. We understand we have that capability. We have to be ready to proceed and act on that. We have to let people know that if they're making tanks and are afraid of losing their jobs, well, you know, the same kind of technology and retooling, we can create mass transit cars. Really, I mean, we have to. The same kind of machining that can go to creating missiles can be used to create wind and solar microtechnologies that can be, you know, installed in tens of millions of American homes. Lowering our carbon footprint, reducing our energy costs. Swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks. You know, we know the path. The path is there. It's clear. We only have to have the resolve to go in that direction. Today, the Los Angeles City Council passed a resolution, and I think it was really a very important occasion because they are now one of the largest cities in America, to come out and declare that they are in favor of the United States Congress passing a resolution or passing a law to create a cabinet-level Department of Peace and Nonviolence. Now, on July the 11th, 2001, I introduced this legislation. Some people looked at it and said, ah, that's pretty funny, Dennis, the Department of Peace. Virginia experienced its tragedy with the shootings. Yesterday, Omaha experienced a tragedy. One of the commentators nationally raised the question, what is it in our society? See, I think we can have compassion for what people go through, and we must. But we also need to look at the underlying assumptions in our society about the inevitability of violence. So the Department of Peace and Nonviolence actually looks at domestic violence, spousal abuse, child abuse. Now, let me tell you, it is so easy to stand up here and advocate peace on earth. Try advocating it in your own home. Another, really, another story. Because we all understand that you know, homes can be cauldrons of emotion. I mean, being compassionate with each other, we can recognize this. But what if we taught our children principles of nonviolence? What if we began a shift in our culture, becoming resonant with the kinds of principles that leaders like Gandhi and Dr. King and Christ and others spoke about, practiced? We speak of this as being a season of peace on earth, goodwill towards all. But to put these practices into the everyday life of our nation, which is what this legislation is really about, in a secular way, is to give us a chance to escape this kind of a chains that we carry around, kind of like Marley rattling in the Christmas carol, the chains from Christmas past, not being able to escape them. We have to break these kind of heart-forged chains of our consciousness that lock us into a kind of a violence against each other and violence within. And the Department of Peace and Nonviolence looks, not just looks at it, but takes all the talent in our society and uses it to create programs where we support community groups that are working on domestic violence programs. It's kind of late to deal with domestic violence when it's in an emergency room or a courtroom or worse. But if you start to change people's attitudes and really look at it, you start to change the country. The same thing with violence in the schools. Gun violence, gang violence, racial violence. See, if our country was based on a notion of the perfectibility of humankind, think about this. If we truly have this capacity, if forming a more perfect union was not simply about a gathering of states, but could also be applied to the imperative of human unity and the imperative of each one of us trying to be whole, then we have the opportunity to participate not only in the evolution of our nation, but in the evolution of ourselves. I want to call forth the capacity of the American people that I know is out there to be not just better than we all are, but to go far beyond what anybody could have ever dreamed that we could become as a nation, to see the possibilities that are just out there waiting to be called forward, whether it's in energy, environment, in peace, in education, in healthcare, in all those areas. We have not even begun to touch the potential that we have. And I'm sure many of you feel the same way. And the heart sickness that we have about our condition as a nation today is about not only knowing how disconnected we are from what we can become. But it's a feeling that
no matter how good we know we can be, that we're not going to get there because there's this not a common awareness. I want to call forth that common awareness. Wake it up. Show America where we can be. Show America that war is not necessary. We can defend this country, but we don't defend it with aggressive war. We defend it with aggressive diplomacy. We don't defend it by bombing other nations. The writer, Michael Fronte, said, you know, you can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb the world to peace. We have to have the capacity. Oh, yeah. We have to have the capacity to see who we can be, what we can become. I waited in a room out there before I spoke, and I looked at this electric candle. And I thought about that light shining in the darkness. And I thought about the scripture that tells us that we should set forth our light. And I thought about those lights that came from candle-lit windows all over this area hundreds of years ago. And I thought about what it would be like if we really discovered our potential as human beings. And I'll tell you what it would be like. It would be like as if we discovered fire for the second time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Charlottesville. Thank you, Mayor.
Do a little Q&A.
Yeah. Thank you.
If you'd like to ask the congressman a question, there's a microphone, and you can form a line right in the middle of the room, and the congressman will be glad to answer a few questions. Sarah.
I was wondering if Bush and Cheney are not impeached, is there a chance of indicting them, and how would we go about that?
Now, first of all, I believe that there has to be accountability, and there cannot be immunity for war crimes. Cannot be immunity for war crimes. When a million innocent Iraqis are killed based on lies, we are challenged to respond from the depths of our humanity. It's really a question of who we are, not who Mr. Bush or Mr. Cheney happens to be, but it's really a question of who we are. It's a question of where our heart is, where our soul is, where our moral values are. And so the answer is, yes, they have to be held accountable. Now, they're either going to be held accountable by the Constitution of the United States, or they're going to be held accountable by law in this country. And just to read a section that you might be interested in. Article 6 of the Constitution says that all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. I want to let you know what the implications are of that. that the United States has been a signatory to treaties that have to do with upholding human rights and have to do with not violating sovereignty. And so there's no escape from accountability here. I just want to make that very clear. To me, it's not important about rousing a crowd and saying, yes, they shall be held accountable. But I will tell you this, that anyone who runs for president of the United States or would want to be president of the United States, all the candidates have two chances to demonstrate where they're at with respect to this issue of accountability. First of all, where are they on impeachment? And secondly, where are they on the questions of accountability after these individuals leave office? Because to me, there is no statute of limitations on war crimes. And there's going to have to be... And the souls of a million innocent Iraqis are crying for justice. The souls of nearly 4,000 of our beloved men and women who served must also be accorded justice.
I'm here because during the debates, you had answered a question about the pro-life abortion issue, and you'd made reference to sexual education being one of the answers. My question to you as president, how would you go about correcting the mistake of federally funded abstinence-only education in high schools?
Well, for those who believe in abstinence, that's their business. They want to practice abstinence, that's fine. For those, I mean, really. Really, we shouldn't discourage it if people believe in it. I mean, really, I'm serious. We shouldn't discourage it if people believe it. I don't discourage it, but I also believe that that human sexuality is so uniquely personal, particularly in a democracy, that we've got to be careful about any proscriptions at all, which is why Roe v. Wade becomes very important with respect to the right to privacy. And on the other hand, I don't see it as being separate from the aspirations of those who want to, see abortions become less necessary. See, I think that it's time to have an American president who can heal this. Let me tell you how I would do it. And I understand it's from both sides of the question. Here's what I think needs to be done. I want to heal this country on this issue that has divided it in so many ways that I'm ready to tell the American people we need to stand for sex education, birth control, prenatal care, postnatal care, child care, universal health care, a living wage, all those things that help to support families. And at the same time, protect Roe v. Wade and a woman's right to choose. But we need to do this with compassion for each other. Because this has been a very acrimonious debate. And we need to, you know, people make choices for as many reasons as there are people. And it's not for a president to be able to make those personal decisions for people. It's for a president to support the people in their struggles to try to make these very life-changing decisions. And so that's the kind of president I intend to be. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir, when a military person takes their oath of office, they swear to defend the Constitution and obey the lawful orders of those appointed over them. Can you give us your feeling as to how the higher levels of our military are approaching the idea of legal and illegal orders?
Well, you know, a few years ago, the question of how do our military face the question of illegal or legal orders A few years ago, right after I came into Congress, I had a chance to go to Bosnia and look at the carnage that had happened after, you know, that in the post-war period. And I met with someone who was part of the command structure there, General Burns. Now, I came from that generation that protested the Iraq War, or the Vietnam War, and the Iraq War. And so, you know, we didn't always have the easiest relationship with those who served. So I had a question of General Burns, and I asked him this question. Here's what he told me. He said, I don't like war. He says, I don't like to send men and women who serve under me in harm's way. He says, but if we get an order to do that, that's exactly what we'll do. So those who in the military have a responsibility to serve, a responsibility to follow commands, but as we know, some in conscience have said no. Some have resisted. And so I think that we need to support those who have made the choice to resist, to make sure that if they've done the right thing, that they'll have a chance to be reinstated at some point, and to understand that those who serve intend to serve with honor, but those who sent them on a journey, on a mission that is based on untruths are the ones who are not being honorable. This is a tough thing to look at. But I think that we have to be welcoming to those men and women who are serving right now when they come back. And if they violated international law, then they have to be held accountable. But there's a lot of men and women out there who love this country deeply and are trying to do the right thing and are torn. We're going to have to deal with this war and its aftermath for many years to come. And part of it is going to be to make sure that our soldiers receive the long-term care and comfort they need when they come back. But another part of it, you know, part of my plan to, if I may, just briefly review with you the plan to get out of Iraq and how we do it, end the occupation, close the bases, bring the troops home, have a parallel process of an international security and peacekeeping force that moves in as our troops leave. Now, we can only do that if we end the occupation, because the occupation is fueling the insurgency. But we have to move for diplomacy with Iran and Syria, nations that we generally would spurn and have spurned. We have to open up diplomatic relations, create the conditions for a working relationship so that we can get our troops out of there. But that's going to only be the beginning. Because if we as a nation will ever be secure in the future, we have to repair the breach that has been created between ourselves and the Iraqi people and the Arab world and the Muslim world. And here's how we do it. It begins with these steps. As we leave, we can begin a program of reconciliation between the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Kurds. As we leave, we have to have an honest program of reconstruction so that these dishonest contractors who are cheating the Iraqi people out of their wealth must leave that country. And we also have to have a program of reparations. Now, we have to be repairers of the breach. This goes back to our moral obligation to recognize wrong when it's being done and to move to heal it. As President of the United States, I intend to heal our relationship with the Arab and the Muslim world so they'll know that we're people of heart, that we're people of conscience, that we're people who believe in human dignity, that we're people who believe in the truth, and we have leaders who will stand by it and will embrace the Muslim and the Arab world in peace. We need a leader that has that capacity, and I'm ready to do that confidently.
Hi. My name is Charlotte Wellen. I'm a teacher in Albemarle County Schools, and what you said about education really touched me. I teach in an amazing school here in the county that is based on the ideas of peace. We don't fail students. We don't punish students. We work things out. We mediate, and we use respect. And I've seen so many students every day transform themselves in that kind of environment. So I know what you're saying is true, and it can work all over the country, not just in our little school. It can work everywhere. And I wondered if you would be interested at all in setting up some kind of forum for teachers and students to talk with each other about these ideas on a nationwide setting, because I think we need to talk about it. And I know, for instance, my students have a ton to say. I take them all over the country to talk about these ideas with other students and teachers, and they always get standing ovations because people have never heard these ideas from students before. And I would love to have a chance for them to talk on a nationwide level with each other about it, if you're interested in that.
Well, let me tell you, thank you very much. You know, aside from being a six-term member of the United States Congress and presidential candidate, I also happen to be chairman of the Domestic Policy Subcommittee. And what I'd like to ask our sister, who raised a question, and it works with the students, is that this is what's great about these meetings, because ideas and possibilities can be born from them. I want to be immediately responsive to your suggestion and invite you to bring your class to Washington so that they can address our Domestic Policy Subcommittee and talk about... Thank you. And I want to take you and your class, if you haven't been there before, I'm sure you have, but if you're, the members of your class haven't, I want to have them walk up the stairs of the House of Representatives with me, because I want to show them something. And I want to share with all of you tonight an image. And it's a good image for us to carry with us. As you walk up the steps of the House of Representatives, above the canopy of the House, there is what's called a pediment with a series of sculptures inside. And at the center sculpture, dead center above the entrance to the House of Representatives, is that of a woman whose arm is outstretched, and she is protecting a child who is sitting blissfully next to a pile of books. Now, the title of this sculpture, which is right at the center of our national experience of the People's House, the title of this sculpture, Peace, Protecting Genius. The goddess of peace protects the child genius. I might add, not with nuclear arms, but with the arms of maternal love. Let's make arrangements to meet there, to have the children not just see that, but come before the committee and share their awareness. And that's the beginning. I so appreciate that you came forward with that. Thank you so much. Yes. And I'm going to be available until 9:15, so we have about 13 minutes. So I'll try to keep my answers brief. It's hard, but I'll try.
Hi. Recently, I have been doing my own, about in the past year or so, I've been doing my own investigation of the attacks of September 11, 2001, and the attacks that the current administration and the media has really chosen to ignore. And I have had the privilege of talking recently with family members of victims and first responders and just citizens in general who really support an independent, you know, open investigation that will actually tell people what they want to know or what have been asking them. So my question is if you support a new investigation and what you would do to keep it open and everyone to hear.
Thank you very much. I just, the aftermath of 9/11 still has left this country in kind of an emotional cul-de-sac. Once the administration took us into a war based on lies, we were still stuck with this problem of trying to work out what actually happened, and the distrust of the government runs very deep. And this is a problem, because trust is what I would call the implicate order. It holds it all together. If you don't have trust, you can't stand on solid ground. If you don't have trust in a relationship falls apart.
If you don't have, if you can't rely on trust when you get, you know, when you get out of the home in the morning, you take your car and your car breaks down. If that keeps happening, you don't, trust doesn't, you know, just falls apart. You're flying a plane, it starts having problems. There's a trust thing that goes on. I mean, you know, Chinese, you know, the toys coming from China, there's a trust problem here because there's contamination. So we have to realize the role of trust. We often don't think about it. How much we depend, how much we trust in order to just live. When there's a breakdown of trust in a society, and there is a huge breakdown of trust today, people need reassurance. So because I understand how deeply broken down the trust is, because I know that there are so many people who have so many questions that haven't been resolved, of course, you know, I'd have no difficulty at all impaneling, you know, a second commission that would have free rein to go into every question and to try to restore the American people's trust. If it, you know, who knows whether they'd come to the same conclusions or not. That's not for me to say, but it is for me to say that as President of the United States, I really want to heal this country. I want to help America get back to a position where people can trust government again and where we can trust each other again, where we can lift this veil of fear that has dropped like a dark cloth on the consciousness of this nation and have a sense of lightness about us again so that we're not so prone to fear. Because this drumbeat of fear, which has been so deeply ingrained into so many of our fellow countrymen and women, is really adverse to who we are. It defies a deeper truth of who we are as Americans because we're not innately fearful people. And so to call forth that courage is to also stand for the ability to take another look at something and to do it without any fear of what we may find. Thank you very much. Next question.
You're bringing forth light and truth into the public arena like no other candidate I've seen. I want to thank you for that out of the depth of my heart. My question is a short one. It involves the FCC moving forward to create concentration or to allow concentration of big media. And it seems to me the reason your message of truth and light isn't getting out as much as it should is because the corporate media is so concentrated. What do you think could be done as president or by Congress to liberate the voice of the people?
You know, it feels that way in a debate, so that's why I asked myself a question the other day. The democratization of our media is central to being able to protect our democratic traditions. The concentration of media ownership is really adverse to the public interest. Now, in 1934, when the Federal Communications Act was passed, the underlying principle and the statement of intent written in the law is that the electronic broadcast media should serve in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. It's right there in the law. The public interest, convenience, and necessity. We need to remind the people that the airwaves do not belong to corporate interests. They don't belong to them. Very important. And so what I would do is this. I would work to break up the monopolies in media, in radio and TV, to move to force any media companies, actually to move to force any defense contractors to divest of media holdings. To reinstate the fairness doctrine. To give people access again to the community, to support community television again, which is in danger of being obliterated. To make sure that public television is not dependent on corporate sponsors. It's just ruining public TV and radio.
But there's another thing here, too, and let's not miss the point. Let's not disempower ourselves. We have to realize that the Internet has opened up all new ways of communicating. It's a kind of a re-empowerment that goes on. We have to believe in our own capacity to be carriers of a message. We're all mediums in that way. So we do not have to concede to these big structures that somehow, oh, we're so powerless and they're so powerful. Let me take a page out of that great political philosopher, Lewis Carroll. Oh, yeah. So, Alice in Wonderland. There's a point at which the minions of the queen, these big cards, are marching on little Alice, okay? And they're marching on her. And Alice thinks that she is about to be done in, okay? And there's this moment when she was really facing her own mortality. But then Lewis Carroll writes that Alice suddenly grew to her full size. And then the cards were really small. And so then she sweeps out her hand and she says, "Who cares for you? You're nothing but a pack of cards." So, class, think about this. Think about what it means. Think about what it means. When we, each one of us, comes to an understanding of the power of our own humanity to be able to get out a message. Think about that. Next question.
Congressman, I'm really happy to hear that free college education is on your radar screen. I actually went to Jefferson's University, and it was free when he started it. Anyway, is mountaintop removal mining on your
what?
Is mountaintop removal mining on your radar screen?
Well,
because we have to save our ancient mountains, the Appalachians.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most stirring speeches that Dr. King ever gave is when he said, "I've been to the mountaintop, but you know, I don't intend to be the president who says I've been to the mountaintop and removed it." We need to preserve our natural world. As a matter of fact, the writer Thomas Berry said that the greatest work in our life, in the title of his book, The Great Work, is to reconcile ourselves with nature. That's the great work of our life. Now, when we look at the destruction of our natural world, what we have seen is that we've separated ourselves from nature. The writer Morris Berman, in his book, The Reenchantment of the World, writes about how this schism created in the Industrial Revolution, where we separated ourselves from nature. And so we're at a moment where it becomes urgent that we reconcile ourselves with nature to save the planet. So that means that we've got to take a different look at these practices that have destroyed the earth, that have ruined the natural environment, that part of that reconciliation with nature must be to move our energy and environmental policies towards sustainability, towards wind and solar and green energy, away from oil, coal, and nuclear. A carbon-free and a nuclear-free future is one that is sustainable and reconciles ourselves with nature.
It is an honor to meet you. I've been following you for a little while now. As a fellow vegan, I am very concerned about the welfare of all animals, but particularly livestock. I'm sure you're aware of what they go through at the mass farming places. What can you do to help their situation or to lessen their suffering?
Thank you. First of all, you make the point about how livestock is treated. I mean, there are compassionate and humane ways that have to be enforced. So under a Kucinich administration,
the U.S. Department of Agriculture will be charged with the responsibility to make sure that humane and compassionate practices are used in raising livestock. Now, you know, I myself, as you point out, you know, I'm a vegan. When you tell people you're a vegan, they say, I thought you were a Democrat. But I am a vegan. It is a kind of a way of life, of food. And you know, I want to share something with you, okay? I got a book out right now called The Courage to Survive, and I tell the first story of my first 21 years where I had Crohn's disease, and bad, almost killed me. And one of the things, when I changed my diet years later, I you know, that plus a little bit of Chinese medicine cured. I mean, it's an amazing thing. So diet, you know, if we are what we eat, folks, we ought to, you know, consider what we put into ourselves, and then we'll know what we'll become. And so I've made some choices, and by going on this path of a diet that basically is meat and dairy and chicken and fish free, I'm, you know, I've put myself on a path of health, but also it put me in rhythm with compassion for animals. And so, you know, I appreciate you bringing that up because, you know, this idea that somehow we're at the top of the chain, this is what's destroying the world, really, because we have to see ourselves as part of a seamless web of life here, where we're connected to all things in the universe. Okay, final question. Yes, sir.
Could you give us your thoughts on how we might deal with the imminence of peak oil?
The question deals with peak oil. Look, Barry Commoner wrote 40 years ago books about how we can't keep assaulting the environment without there being consequences. This extractive technology has had enormous effects on our global climate, but at the same time we see we're running out of it. There's a point at which there's a diminishing supply. When we see the connection in the UN panel, governmental panel on climate change, about the increased hydrocarbons being connected to warming of the temperature of the earth and that being connected to melting of ice sheets and sea levels going up, we start to understand that there really is a man-made effect on the environment, and if we affect it adversely, well, then we know we have some choices about affecting it in a positive way. So instead of having leadership which pits people against each other and we're fighting each other, we need to unite as a global community to meet this challenge. Now, we certainly have to move away from oil. And where John Kennedy had such an enormous impact on myself, I remember watching his inauguration from Sister Sabina's ninth grade economics class at St. John Cantius High School. And when he said, let the word go forth from this time and place that the torch had been passed to a new generation of Americans, he was sending out a message of change. When he said, so I say unto you, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. He was enlisting all of us in a common effort. A year later, he challenged us to reach for the stars. And so many of us became involved in a pursuit of science and technology, and we felt part of a common effort. Taking a page from President Kennedy, I want to rally the American people in a common effort, in the cause of conservation, in the cause of energy efficiency, so that each one of us, you know, from the children to many generations, all play a role in helping to make America more productive, more environmentally responsive, more energy efficient, more moving towards green energy. I mean, if you can imagine what it would be like to have a nation working together cooperatively
in kind of like a common spirit, where we really could do the work of repairing the globe in this season of lights. It's worth remembering from Judaism, the concept of tikkun olam, the healing of the world. This is the moment when we get our opportunity and our time to play a role, however small, in healing the world. But as we do that together, we, in fact, help to create that which it is we desire. It was almost 30 years ago, actually 29 years ago, for, excuse me, let me do the math here, 39 years ago in Cape Town, South Africa. A U.S. senator was visiting and witnessing apartheid. He was speaking to African-American, or rather African students, who lived apartheid and who had great skepticism when he told them that things will change. The day will come when apartheid will no longer rule Africa. And these students looked at this Caucasian U.S. senator and were absolutely incredulous. And here's what he said to them. To tell them how it was going to be different. He said, each time a man or a woman stands up for an ideal, acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he or she sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. And crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples can create a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. That was Robert F. Kennedy, and that's my commitment, and I'm sure it is yours too. Thank you very much.
I will. Couple of brief announcements before anybody goes anywhere.